Well, you ready? We are working on page 327. And I found it rather difficult, this page. Part of it is, I think, they're incomplete formulations.
Yeah, he just starts talking about this son, and you can hardly tell he's talking about it.
Well, that's, you know, if you remember going through Zarathustra, that's a great help, where in one sentence, or in one paragraph, one sentence is from the ego, one sentence is from the anima, one sentence is from the shadow, and they're all contradictory, and you got to stop and figure out what's what. It's not that bad here, but that just alerted me to how you have to read this stuff at points. In alchemy, that's the massa confusa. It's just a bunch of confusing stuff. And, you know, the more we regress, you might say, or the more we degenerate mentally, the more that's the nature of the thought process. It's just all over the place. And what the ego then has to do is go back and say, okay, now this is true, this is not true, this is true, this is not true. Now, I don't think there's things that are false here, but there are things that I will try to show you, recast in a wider context. The issue then is basically he's trying to get rid of Salome. We've been dealing with that for a week or two. And he's contrasting love, flesh, and life. They're not the power of the flesh. See where I am on 327. And I think we've got to go back and put ourselves in his state of mind. He's, you know, not even 40. He's 38 years old. He, from all accounts, books notwithstanding, but from family members, he was a loving father. And he's feeling torn that he loves his family, but he's got this other erotic, I'm going to call it love, and he feels that, in a way, love has betrayed him, because it's put him into a conflict. I tell you what his eldest, well, I guess it's his youngest daughter, Lil, said to my friend. My friend's in France. She is friends with Jung's surviving daughter, who I think now must be like mid or upper 90s and still does workshops on Russian iconography in the Alps. And she said to my friend, you know, one of the worst things about getting old is I've run out of energy, and these are her words, defending my dad against the bastards who are tearing him down. And she said he was a wonderful father. We'd sit around in the evening. Sometimes he'd work, and we'd leave him alone. Sometimes we'd sing together as a family. We'd play checkers. So that's the portrait I have of him as a family man. And then he's got this other kind of a physically based, but moving into a deeper spiritual relationship with Tony Wolf. So that's why I think he's seeing love and life and flesh as contradictory. Love was love for his family. Life was the fact that his erotic energy is pulling him away from what he considered love to be. Now, I dug back in memories, and here is his final thought on love, and you'll see that it leaves room for all three of these, but at this point in his life, he didn't see love that way. He hadn't cooked enough. But this is from Memories, page 353. In my medical experience, as well as in my own life, I have again and again been faced with the mystery of love, and I've never been able to explain what it is. We cannot discuss one side of it without also discussing the other. No language is adequate to this paradox. Whatever one can say, no words can express the whole. See, that's the whole that he has now come to. He doesn't have the whole here. That's why it's so confusing. To speak of partial aspects is always too much or too little. Only the whole is meaningful. Love bears all things and endures all things, 1 Corinthians 13:7. These words say all there is to be said. Nothing can be added to them, for we are in the deepest sense the victim of the victim and instrument of cosmogonic love. See, the victim aspect is what he hadn't quite come to terms with here, I would say.
Could you repeat that phrase?
Yeah, nothing, for in the deepest sense, for we are in the deepest sense the victim and instruments of cosmogonic love. Cosmogonic, I'm not sure how you pronounce that.
And what does that mean?
The love that creates the universe. Cosmos.
The victims and the...
Victim and the instruments.
Instruments.
See, he's realizing now that he was an instrument of Eros.
But he was compartmentalizing his life at this point.
At that point, he was compartmentalizing it.
Right.
Which I think anyone would do.
Absolutely.
A man can try to name love, showering upon it all the names at his command, and still he will involve himself in endless self-deception. If he possesses a grain of wisdom, he will lay down his arms and name the unknown by the more unknown. That's a phrase from alchemy. Ignotum par ignotius. That is, by the name of God. That is a confession of his subjection, his imperfection, and his dependence, but at the same time a testimony to his freedom to choose between truth and error. He has evolved since that time. But what he's working with here is, I think, feeling love means family love, flesh means Tony Wolf, and life is, I got to follow this passion which seems to be detracting from my family love. That's how I would put it. And so he says, this distinction is terrible.
Where are you now?
Middle of the first column on 327. Sorry, I skipped some. Yeah, go ahead.
It doesn't seem so strange if you think of the idea that the God, whatever you want to call it, creative power, doesn't have all these mores.
Absolutely.
But he doesn't have all this invention.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been in, I did learn a couple of things in divinity school, not many, but I was at these conferences where liberals and conservatives would confront each other. And, the conservatives would say, oh, yes, God is love. And the liberals would say, yeah, as long as it's missionary position, heterosexual, twice a week. What if it's gay love? What if it's perverse love? What if it's kinky love? What if it's a love between a man and a child? What about that? And I think we've got to say, that's all God. And recognizing when we say God is love, what that entails is a mighty big leap. Yeah. I skipped some. Let's go back. Not the power of flesh, but of love. See where I am in the middle of the first column on 327. Not the power of flesh, but of love should be broken for the sake of life. So he's saying, I would rather give up love than this physical desire. Now you can see the Freudian input there. Since life stands above love. So there you've got three compartments, which later he's going to see singularly. And then he compares putting love above life to a man who puts his mother against the demands of life. Again, that's thinking that he would drop. That's
drop.
He's using that reductive metaphor to explain to him this, why he can't unite love and life. He's saying, well, these guys who are true to their family, they're just tied to their mother.
He's telling himself that, I think, so he can justify this affair. But, of course, it's not true. See, there we've got to critique the statement. It was true for him at the time. That last sentence, love seeks to have and to hold, but life wants more. And in a way, you know, I can see what he's driving at. When you say life, when he says life, you can also think Jung's life of writing Jungian psychology. And that he could have stayed in the comfort of his home, but he had to go through this stuff in order to be able to write.
And that is another kind of love.
And that is the deep, that's the world-creating love, absolutely. Of course, this is not clear to him now. By going through this fire, it gets clear to him. And I think certainly that's what his wife realized.
Well, their relationship in their later years is a testament to that fact.
Yeah. So that's what's going on here and why it seems so confusing, because they're half-truths. Later they became integrated. That's how I would read it. And then he kind of laments, the beginning of all things is love, but the being of things is life.
So like the being of things is individuation.
Yeah, individuation, and I am always reading in the back of life creativity. Creativity. That's what he was to be. And it seems like what he was to be and his love are in conflict at this point.
I read that as maybe love being the passion that starts out what you're supposed to do, and the life and the living of it being finding the meaning in it, and then it becomes a task rather than a passion.
Yeah, that's true, but that's a little more advanced. I think that's down the road. That was one of the steps along the way. I think today we don't nearly have this issue. You got to remember, Jung is at the tail end of the Victorian age, where you know the family and walks in this park on Sunday, where everything.
I guess I see it as an unfolding process. Love of family into, you know, then a mature expression of that love between two people, and that energy then takes you out into life somehow.
Yeah. And but for him, though, he at that point felt it was betrayal that was taking him into life.
Because and for the Victorians, love and flesh were very separate things.
Yeah.
And I think we still live under
that. We sure do here. You know, as I mentioned, in Europe, it's much less of an issue. I'm not trying to say they're a bunch of promiscuous people, but they just don't have this idea of monogamy defined in this strictly moral way, moralistic way.
But do they understand from a deeper psychological perspective?
No, I doubt it. Okay. No, I doubt it. But you see it in the way they treat their kids, you know, with sex. They just so make a big deal of it. Well, I don't know if you want to get into it too much, but he gives us a footnote, 340. And I thought I'd just allude to it, if only because it's pretty. The beginning is of all things is love. The editor links us back to Greek creation myths, where love is the mover of the creation. And this is from Kerenes, the gods of the Greeks, page 16. He refers to
the editor refers to the Orphic and the Hesiodic, from Hesiod, creation myths. And they're both short. They're so beautiful, I thought I'd just read them to you. Night, this is according to the Orphic tradition. Night was a bird with black wings. Night conceived of the wind and laid her silver egg in the lap of darkness. From the egg sprang Eros, the god of love. And then from there, Eros creates the world. So there, I think that's what Jung is referring to, the importance of loving creation. And also, not that they mention here, how it comes out of darkness. Darkness is fertilized. And the same thing in Hesiod. In Hesiod, first arose chaos, and then descended, you don't need to worry about these names, but I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Erebos, I'm guessing Erebos, the lightless darkness of the depths, and Nyx, night. You've got the darkness of the depths and night were the first two created beings. Nyx, night, fell in love with Erebos. So night falls in love with darkness. Again, I think that's just so beautiful that they see the creative power of darkness, and from that then comes the creation of the world. But again, the falling in love of darkness and night creates the world. So that's that first sentence. And now he's sort of lamenting, why, O spirit of the darkest depths, do you force me to say that whoever loves does not live, and whoever lives does not love? So he's feeling that he's being driven by dark thoughts to entertain this necessity of seeing love on one hand and flesh on the other. And that's what he does the rest of that paragraph. Should everything turn into its opposite? In other words, this is challenging everything I've ever thought. And I'm forced to think the opposite of what I used to think. That's how I read that. Will there be a sea where Philemon's temple stands? In other words, am I going to lose that wisdom which I worked so hard to ascertain? Is everything sinking? And this mute son of the earth, that's the devil, and he sees the devil behind what he's being forced to do, and he finds it repulsive. So he's fighting with what he has to do.
With the moral implications of it?
Yeah, that his morality is saying what I am entertaining, and probably at this point doing, is from the devil, or devilish.
Yeah, he makes a distinction. That son, he goes on to say, was bothered by the devil.
Right.
So I guess it's the son of the devil.
But the idea is that it's reprehensible.
So, do you suppose that at this point in our text, it struck me that the full implications of the death of his God is coming at him.
Yeah.
And he's looking at his new God image and just seeing it as a worm.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, but then in a page or two he comes to understand.
This will be reworked.
Yeah.
But it's a mood pouring out of him.
Yes. When it just hits him, what his God image is, and what it holds, holds that worm.
Yeah, or what does it really mean to live love?
Mm-hmm.
It's mighty complicated. Because the body doesn't care about social contracts.
So do you think the son of the earth is mute because he hasn't he can't reach it, he can't give any kind of, can't have any kind of communication with it. It hasn't given its purpose. It can't speak its purpose.
Exactly. He can't get it to tell him why he has to do that, or do what he's doing. That's what I imagine. Yeah. There's no dialogue.
It's so like he really just needs to go through the experience.
Go through the experience. Blind. Well, blind maybe not, but trusting that there's, that he's not just an adulterer.
But this idea of Philemon as a fraudster is a passing mood.
That's a passing mood. That's right. That's how I understand it. Yeah. Let's work up to that. So the second column, off with you, you pierce me with paralyzing force. More of the bad mood. What are you doing to me? You don't speak. Your silence is unbearable. And then he's saying, look what I did to you. I won my soul, and where did it get me? You monster. You're banishing me into a state that I don't agree with. You're tearing up traditional Christian values. That's how I would read the rip open the belly of old cathedrals. So basically he's saying damn it for quite a few paragraphs. I always remember Robert Johnson telling that lovely story where he had a horrible life, that poor guy. He lost his leg when he was about 15, I think, 14. He was walking in Seattle, I think it was, all those hills, and a car, walking between two cars, and the brake failed and ran and smashed his leg, and he lost it. So fast forward to when he was in therapy, I'm not sure who he's working with, maybe this guy Fritz Konkel, but the guy, his analyst, said, now, I want you to go home and just try to see what your inside wants to say. So he went home and sat, didn't get anything, came back, and he said, well, I tried, nothing came. And the guy said, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm sitting in my typewriter. He said, well, go home, try it again, just sit there and see what wants to come. So Johnson went home, sat, came back. Nothing, he said. I didn't get anything. So the analyst said, well, go home and see what your typewriter wants to say. So he went home, came back, and he said, you know, all my typewriter wants to say is, God damn it. That's what I think. When you really realize if your fate in the long run is going to be creative, but you have to go through a difficult time, that's the emotion that you have to face. And that's what he's going through now. So, I recognize you, Philemon, you most cunning of all fraudsters. He's just mad at what he has to go through. And remember, within about, I don't know exactly where we are, but I think within about 2 months, in April of 1914, he resigned from the psychoanalytic presidency. So that's in his mind, too. That here he is on this fast track to success, psychiatrist, beautiful home, nice family. What's he doing all this other stuff for? And he's mad about it. He links himself up to Odin. There, about halfway down, a little bit more than halfway down that paragraph. Odin, remember, is Votan, and Votan had to hang upside down on a tree for 9 days, and that. He, I think, he had to sacrifice an eye, and then he got knowledge of the runes. And the runes are both the alphabet, the Germanic alphabet, and blocks of those alphabets, or embossed letters on blocks, which I don't quite know how it works, but they use as an oracle. So he's getting both the gift of language and the ability to read the mystery. Through this hanging, and Jung said, that's what I'm doing. I'm just hanging upside down.
So he's getting the ability to live a more symbolic life.
Yeah. And remember,
We had that big section on magic, which here has become mystery. And as you've heard me say many times, we really don't know why we change. We work on the dreams, and then one day you change, or one day you don't. And how that works is still a mystery. We know kind of how to proceed, what attitudes on our part can help it, what can hurt it, but really this ability to grow is a mystery. I think you particularly see that when your growth is augmented by a synchronistic experience. That, where did that come from? So back, you gave me the force of magic, which I would take in later formulations to be the mystery of alchemical or the mystery of inner transformation. And what do I get is a puny basilisk, and a basilisk is a poisonous serpent. So he thinks he's starting out to grow, and look what he's ended up with, he said. And then he calls his soul an adulterous whore. Well, that's exactly what we've been saying. And a little farther down, you broke life, love, and life. Also what we've been saying, he doesn't see anymore how love and life are linked. But that's all a rant, as I understand it. And then he comes back to Salome. Where is Salome? Where is the unresolvable question of love? So now he's about ready to accept what he has to do. And then his serpent comes up to him and tells him a fairy tale. A theme which we've alluded to, and I just want to bring us back to it, is what the editor refers to in footnote 344. So see, we're February 23rd, 1914, and I think it was April that, as I said, I think he resigned from the Freudian world. But in the Black Book, the dialogue is with the soul, but we've seen how soul and serpent's the physiological aspect of the soul. And this section begins with Jung asking her what is stopping him from getting back to his work, and she tells him that it is his ambition. He thought he'd overcome it, but she said that he had simply negated it, and thus tells him the tale that follows. So in the back of this is his sacrificing his ambition. And that ambition would be, as I mentioned, nice house, nice wife, nice family, psychiatrist, kind of the darling of the city, and he gives it all up. We'll come back to this in the scrutinies, because the scrutinies just beat him up with this thought of ambition. And just, we'll look at it more there, but just for the sake of it here, I think the difference between, I'm going to say, genuine ambition and disingenuous ambition hasn't yet been made clear to him yet. The difference is, real ambition would be the goal of the self to create Jungian psychology. And what makes it genuine is he will, and anyone trying to live this way, will continue speaking their idea of truth no matter how it's received. Where disingenuous ambition, which he hasn't yet gotten clear, plays to the marketplace. So, I don't think ambition is wrong, but here he's sort of making it wrong.
It's just whether that ambition is rooted in the self or the ego. And where you can distinguish the two is how the person reacts when their work is rejected. Here, I think it's probably to say, if it's safe to say, it was disingenuous ambition. And that's what he was sacrificing. Yeah. Yeah, we'll get there. I just wanted to lay that out.
So those are the goals of the ego.
Yeah. Okay. And they're very close.
And are they directed by the spirit of the times?
The ego would be directed by the spirit of the times, the self by the spirit of the depths. And, you know, that's one of my problems with this Deirdre Baer book. She continually accuses Jung of being ambitious and of, you know, mowing down anybody in his way, which is kind of true. But what she doesn't realize is that was the ambition from the self. And he kept on his line no matter whether he was well received or not. That's the distinction. But the self wants its intentions realized in life. And that means fighting, you know, knowing how to get your ideas across, having the right friends. But the difference is you are true to the inspiration. You're not changing your message to make it sell well. If the choice comes down to not selling well or being truthful, you'll choose being truthful.
Well, in that, could we say that Nietzsche was true to the to the self?
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, I mean, there were things along the way that could have helped him be more accepted, and his ego couldn't let him do that.
Right.
Okay.
Absolutely. I think that's why Jung liked Nietzsche so much.
I was thinking about the scripture that says he lost his father and mother. More than he is not worthy.
Yeah, that's the same thing in a biblical framework. Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's not to say he did not love his family, because he did throughout his whole life. But at that time, family was everything.
Yeah.
And even today, we do have that.
Yeah.
But the greatest gift he probably gave his children was to become who he was.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And they all married and lived happily.
And had full lives.
And had full lives.
Most of them, right?
Mm-hmm. So now we get a fairy tale. Which I will summarize. I don't think we need to read the whole thing. But a king had no children. And the wise woman he goes to in the forest, of course, tells him, now I have racked my brains over this one. Take a pound of otter lard. That is the one word, the one animal that Jung never commented on. I looked everywhere in the collected works. I looked in Darrell Sharpe's index of Jungian literature. Nobody has ever commented on the otter. So we'll have to speculate.
Well, we know it's a deer substance because it was hard to find the otter lard.
A deer substance, okay. I'm open.
The otter is known for its playfulness.
Here's what I found out. They're known for their playfulness. They can either be introverted or extroverted. Some otters are solitary and some are very social. Where I think it might become relevant is that it can dive down 100 feet and it can stand cold water. So the lard would be the otter's ability to stand the coldness of diving down. Well, what's Jung doing but diving down? And what does it mean to go your own way but to be cold?
Right, and to have a lot of lard is to have a lot of fat to protect you from the elements.
Right. So that is a guess on my part. But he has to dig a pound of otter's... No, take a pound of otter lard. It's even hard to say.
bury it, and then a child is born. Make a long...
Just one more thing on the otter. What struck me is it's a mammal that lives on land and sea, where most of the mammals are either sea or land, the amphibians.
That's a good point.
Land and sea.
I think we're probably in the right area. That has something to do with a metaphor for relating to the unconscious, to the conscious and going down, and the coldness, and the playfulness. I think basically they're good-natured, except when they're reproducing.
Or threatened.
Yeah. I remember along the California coast, you'd see them coming up and sunning. They're just delightful to watch. Well, child is born. The child becomes competitive, and the father kills him. Has him killed. And then he feels bad. And the witch in the forest says, well, do it again. He does it again. A child is born, and this time the father does not kill him. He lets the boy live and crowns him king. Well, I think the boy will see, he even says it directly. Look at footnote 346. That the son is the work. So, yeah. So that the son would be Jung's life work. And when it first comes up, he doesn't want it. And he kills it. And he realizes what he's done. He tries it again. So in our jargon, it would be the first is the ego kills the self. In the second case, the ego realizes the self is the boss and serves it. So that's why I think we're okay, Carol, to say that the previous paragraphs were a rant. Mm-hmm. That was killing the son in those mm-hmm. paragraphs. And here... You see why I say that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And here, he's reversing his resistance.
So the child competing with him is the self trying to get him.
Take over.
Yeah.
And determine how he's going to spend his life.
That's the renewal of the king motif.
Yeah, and you can see how when he read alchemy, he must have gone bonkers. As far as I know, he was not familiar with alchemy at this point, other than maybe what he would have learned in a history class.
For some reason, I was thinking a lot about Istvar and the egg, and how when Istvar broke out of the egg, we couldn't figure out why, you know, the whole thing with Jung had gone in his pocket. That whole inflation, maybe that was part of the ego wanting to have the inflation of the self without being subservient.
Absolutely. Without paying the price. Yeah, that's a good point, Neil. Well, so that's the tale. That takes us over to the top of the second column on 328. And then he starts talking with the serpent again about the story. And what comes out of that is the sun is your work. And your crowning it means you are granting it sovereignty to organize your life.
And a few pages back, he gets the crown. And we talked about where I suggested the crown is the means by which all that creative energy is funneled through in a more positive way than a chaotic way. And here is where the crown then comes in and how the process is. Are we seeing the process of individuation?
Crown goes to the sun.
In the fairy tale then?
Mm-hmm. So that's the first half of the page, first half of the second column. But another little problem comes up, which is what it feels like to serve the self is you feel childish. You go to any of these men's business meetings, it's just a bunch of peacocks. Each trying to outshine the other. That has no place in the creative process. And he's realizing that. I'm not going to be a regular guy anymore.
That's the competitive.
That's the competitive. Yeah, yeah. That he feels one down. And that he's more like a mother birthing a child, you might say, than a man building a company, to use a kind of modern...
Is the serpent telling this?
To create means mother and child.
So he becomes the mother of this child,
yeah.
Then.
Which is a turnaround to the traditional idea of the man. I sympathize totally. A really important. A couple of reportees are where the serpent says a salutary antidote against power. See where I am? I'm about two-thirds of the way down. Everybody see it? See it, Ann?
No, but
And the footnotes are important. A salutary antidote against, the footnote says, in the black book, the word is ambition. And then, don't resist being a child, otherwise you resist your son, and the black book says, your work. So that's what's going on there, I think. And the rest of it is simply supporting that basic line.
Such an important distinction.
It's huge. And it comes back in the scrutinies. So we'll see it again. You know, you have to be just as tough, just as aggressive in a way, just as savvy, fighting, but you do it for the sake of the work, not for the sake of the praise. And sometimes they don't have to be separate. But when they do have to be separate, you can see where the ego is involved if the message changes. If the message stays the same, despite the rejection, then that's the self.
In a way, it surprises me a little that his, I suppose we could say this is his new God image, this son. That it is a son. I sort of thought it might be somehow... something else.
Oh, more hermaphroditic?
I don't know. But, you know, the son, we think of Christ right away.
Yeah.
And I guess I thought it might be something different.
But I think this is just a very provisional first manifestation. And it does change. It gets far more complex. So by the time he gets to Ion, you know, what he does with the self there is so differentiated. You know. But what he's just trying to get straight is, I'm resigning from the psychoanalytic society. I'm having an affair. I had a golden track to success. Now what have I got? The shame of the community. People think I'm crazy. Am I, you know, I think anyone would say, am I just self-destructive? Why can't I enjoy what I have? Why do I have to make it so damn complicated? And there are people who do that just because they're losers. But to find a deeper sense of success means going through that process.
Well, the fact that he could follow this vision mm-hmm. is pretty incredible. If he was that powerful and
yeah.
well-connected, and that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
To me, to not do it would take a toll.
Yeah. They would have killed him.
To have to forget all of that and try to live in the world of ambition,
mm-hmm.
he would be cutting off his soul, mm-hmm. actually. And so you have to weigh. I guess you have to weigh which is, you know, either way you're going to suffer.
Yeah.
So why not do the thing that
yeah.
feeds your soul?
Yeah. And that leaves something for your family.
Right. And the world. Well,
and the
for
world.
Him, for the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, not all of us have that, but
I think, yeah, we can say that now, but for him to say it the first time, this is just
I think so too, yeah. I agree. Where did he get the damn idea? I don't know. But he got it.
A lot of Otter Lars.
Well, I'm amazed at how many pieces of scripture keep jumping out about this process
mm-hmm.
where Jesus has let the children come yeah. to me because of such as the kingdom mm-hmm. of God, and there was another one which I'm going through my head and up the other side.
I was thinking at one point in our reading, which I don't think we've gotten to yet, about Jesus being tempted by the devil, you know, get down. And you can have the whole world. And that was the temptation. You can have the whole world.
That yeah, was the thing about, you know, why do you save up stuff in your barns, save things, because tonight your soul may be required of you, and that's
mm-hmm.
exactly
mm-hmm.
what our society is. You know, one of our barns that are.
I agree.
You
know, I've said this before in other things. You weren't here, but I think Jungian psychology is really an attempt to evolve Christianity. And it scares the bejeebies out of the Christians, but it is highly Christian work. You know, forget the word Christian if that's offensive. It's highly religious work that our understanding of God has to change. And a lot of what Christianity says isn't wrong, it's just incomplete, limited, and maybe at the time genuine, but now taken on its obvious level wrong.
Want to hear an interesting synchronicity?
Yeah.
The night before the Pope resigned?
Yes.
A big bolt of lightning struck that.
Yeah. I heard that.
I did hear that.
I saw a picture of it. You know, that big dome, like the, what is it called? Is that
Peter's
dome? Yeah, dome. Yeah, there's a big bolt of lightning coming right to the...
God has spoken.
I love it. Oh, that's wonderful.
Is that
the modern equivalent of poop?
Maybe it was like, hurry up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me hear the process along a little bit for you here.
Maybe it's Zeus coming down and saying, okay, son, you've had your time now. It's over. I'm killing you.
Yeah.
You're a gone.
Well, maybe it was an affirmation for the Pope. But yep, that's the right thing to do. I'll highlight it for you.
Yeah, we'll see what they bring in.
Yeah, that's going to be the problem. They just get another moron in there.
They're full of power. It's all about power.
It's all about power.
And actually, this is probably the most selfless act
that man's ever done. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's pretty self-serving. I still think that he could have gotten a lot of trouble about this cover-up.
He was very involved, yeah. And
he was
very high
involved.
Up and involved in keeping it covered up.
Yeah. And I don't think they were finished with him. Yeah.
No, it's just hideous. It is just hideous.
The question I had is we read this material over and over and over again, you know, the second coming, and Dionysus was before him, and who was before him, and who's before him. Does anyone do that kind of comparative religion thing? I'm sure there has to be. Not just religion, it's such a the evolution, yeah.
This is a very... very shallow way Bill Maher did it.
Yeah.
What was that movie?
Religiosity. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And his take is, you know, we all need to be atheists, but he does point out, this is all just the same thing regurgitated. Mm-hmm. It doesn't, and his, of course, is that it has no truth to it, whereas Jung says it has a lot of truth to it. It's just not the truth that you're pulling out of it. Mm-hmm. It's not something to bang over other people's heads in the club. It's something to live out in your own life.
And it is an evolution.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you rent that video,
it's quite funny.
I think it's religiosity.
Yeah,
it's irritating in a way.
It is.
And this is the point.
He points out some of the ridiculousness, like at the Creation Museum. Where they put dinosaurs and humans together because they think if enough people see it, they will begin to believe it. And some of the other things he just...
But he does point out that, you know, there were other... But Christ was not the first one to die and rise again.
Yeah,
it was a recurring thing.
Yeah.
Or the king killing the son. I mean,
Right. Look
at Zeus. He ate all his kids. Yeah. It just goes on. Cool.
Okay. Well, should we have a stretch? Then we'll pick up with point number 2 on 328.